Good evening, everybody. This is Writers in the Round. My guest is poet KB Ballantyne. It occurred to me to start by asking you one of those questions that you're maybe going to look at me and say, I don't know how to answer that. But I was wondering why you write poetry.
I write poetry because I have tried to write other things, and I don't have a real good sense of patience, which it takes for a novel. I'm really good at coming up with ideas and then delving into the words, and then I can put that away, and then I can come back to it later, and it's still that short piece. But I've done the NaNoWriMo, that National Novel Writing in a Month, a couple times when I have my creative writing students do that. And I just find it's so incredibly difficult to keep up with storylines and characters and how everybody's related. And I do that really well when I read. But to write it down and then remember that somebody is related to somebody else, or that, you know, I changed the name of somebody at one point, and one of my readers said, "Do you know that you've changed this person's name?" And I went, "No, I had no idea." And it's just really, it gets really complicated. And I love to read so much. And I thought I would be great at writing novels because that's what I like to read. And the older I get, the more I have really enjoyed nonfiction. And just poetry is, it's something that's a snapshot that I can look at and contemplate for a whole day or however long that poem stays with me. And then I just muse over that. And sometimes I write from other people's poems. Sometimes I do write from the novels that I read or from the nonfiction pieces. One time I read a novel right before I went to bed, which I hardly ever do because I generally stay up and read the whole novel, and which is bad. But for some reason I read the novel, and then I had a dream. I dreamed a poem and I wrote it down. I woke up and I wrote it down in the middle of the night. I found out the hard way. You have to do that if you're going to keep them. And that poem didn't change by one word. It came out full. And I was amazed at that. But that's how much that person's writing touched me. And I want to share. I don't have any other creative things that I can do. I mean, I like to sing. I like to draw. I like to do all sorts of artsy stuff. But I'm not necessarily very good at any of those things. And so I find that if I labor over a poem, I can make it good enough, or what I think is good enough.
Just from everything that you've just said, I'm thinking, here is a talented person who is being rather hard on herself.
Well, it's kind of you to say so.
I thought that it was interesting that at the end of your book, there's a message to the reader. And at the very beginning is a quote from Shakespeare. It seems like they echo each other, which I'm sure was by design, since they bookend the book. But I thought it was really nicely done. The quote from Shakespeare from Julius Caesar, "The skies are painted with unnumbered sparks." That's so cool.
Thank you.
And then to close with the message to the reader.
I don't know if you know Jack Perkins. He was the A&E bio series person. He was an NBC journalist, I think, broadcaster. But he said the poet only sets down the poem, the reader writes it. And I really think, I mean, that's why a lot of people hesitate to teach poetry writing, because it can mean so many different things. I mean, obviously, there has to be something that's on the page that, you know, so for it to be true. You can't just pull out a dinosaur from something that doesn't mention anything about it. But because I can take something away from it because of what's going on in my life, and you can take something else away from it, then I think a lot of people say, well, I don't get poetry. And what I think they don't like is that they can't put a pen in it and dissect it. I mean, you can do that, but that doesn't mean you're going to get the emotional impact out of it, you know, the healing that comes from words that people use poetry for. I mean, why else do we sing songs? That's what poetry is. It's just songs without the music.
It is. Well, we can go into all of that in a moment. Because a couple of things that struck me about your work in terms of poetry, as you know, I've had this conversation with a lot of people about the difference between poetry and a song lyric, and the best definition I have of that was from a friend of mine who said, "Yes, but it doesn't sing. You've got to write it so it sings."
That's right. You know? You really do.
And you don't have to do that with poetry, you know. In a different sense it does, but not in the sense he meant.
Right.
That this reads beautifully, but I can't sing it, you know.
Right. But I think a really good poem would lend itself to song lyrics. I have a friend of mine who plays in a band, and he told me one time, he said, "You know, some of your poems would make really good lyrics to music if you ever want to work on that." And I thought, oh, I mean, that was a really big compliment to me, because that means that he is musically hearing something in my poem which doesn't have music, you know, on a page to it.
Well, one person said about you something about said that you had the ear of a musician. Here it is. KB explores the physical and psychic gradations of light and dark with a naturalist's eye for exquisite detail and a musician's ear for the sonic power of language. And I think that's what he's talking about, you know, is when you write a song, the literal meaning of the words isn't as important as the sound.
That's true. Yeah. You know, you want to be able to walk away and hum it some more.
Yeah, and it has to have, I don't know, there's that that feeling, and I hear it sometimes in some songwriters, that while that probably looked really good when you wrote it down, it doesn't sing very well. It's too wordy, it's too hard to follow, it's ignoring the melody, it's not a song.
Yes.
You know.
You know, I see that a lot in performance poetry versus poems that are on a page. And Maggie Britton Vaughn, who is the Tennessee Poet Laureate, she and I were on a panel one time talking about the difference. She asked me why I broke a line in a certain spot, and I said, "Well, because I wanted to give the reader a visual clue." And she said, then I said, "The difference between our poems is that you write for the ear and I write for the eye." And we just had a really good time on that panel talking about how, you know, sometimes I listen to performance poets and I just think, wow, that is so powerful. That is amazing. And then I ask for the words and then I look at them on the page and they're not as impactful on the page, which is surprising because it's the same thing that the person said. But the language, you know, the immediacy of somebody speaking has a lot to do with that. So, you know, that oral culture of poetry is really important in one respect, but we also now have the printed version of it. And so I think, you know, some people say that one is better than another, and I just really think they're different animals.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with you. And a lot of it, in terms of the spoken part, is the personality of the performer.
Yes.
And I think that's true whether they're singing or they're just reciting doesn't sound right, but sharing their poetry,
right.
You know, speaking their poetry. We haven't quite got the language for that, do we? But there's, and of course, you know, with hip-hop, the power of a person's voice and their delivery and, you know, the way they frame it and the music they use behind them. But even if they have music behind them, it's really just as an accent. It doesn't really, it's not the same as a song, you know.
Right.
But then there's a poem like your poem, Winter's Edge, which is, it seemed to me that's like using words and the way you put them on the page to make a picture.
Yes. I really try to do that a lot. I want, even though I want the reader to walk away with their own idea of what I'm saying, I still want to paint a good enough picture that they do see something, you know, whether it's the something that I see is not necessarily as important to me as that they see something. And so you still have to give a pretty detailed image for readers, I think.
Well, I mean, you are an incredibly visual writer. It's so easy to see what you're describing most of the time.
Thank you.
You know, but the cool thing, as more than one person has pointed out, is there's a lot more going on there. Okay, well, the poems are broken down into groups, light and dark, darker.
Because sometimes life gets that way.
And then it ends with more light.
Right.
Which I, you know, I was like, oh, thank you, KB. So glad you brought it in full circle. Because I certainly don't have any problem with the dark. But it's nice to finish with an optimistic note.
Yes.
You know, or at least the acknowledgement that while life certainly is often dark, even in the midst of light, which I think is one of the strengths of your poetry, is that it's always there. In the poems that are most about light, there's these shadows kind of lurking in the background.
Well, if there's light, there's going to be shadow.
Yeah.
And that's the problem.
It's alive, right?
It is. It is. And I do, even though I don't consider myself an optimist, I feel like I'm more of a realist. I think there really is a lot of light that people miss. And I just want to point that out to people. You know, hey, there's this dark thing that's going on, but hey, look at this light. Even if it's a small light, at least there's something there that's light.
Yeah, why is it that we find it so easy to recognize the dark and to acknowledge it? We have so much more trouble with the light, don't we?
We do. Yes.
You know, there's that notion, it's, I think, probably at this point, a cliche that they say about songwriters, that it's easier to write when your life is not going well for you.
Oh, my gosh. Yes. Yes. And actually, I have written the worst stuff, I think, sometimes when my life is not going well because I'm just so obsessed with whatever the thing is. But if I can look past the thing and move on, or even write my way through it and write some really awful, awful stuff that will never see the light of day anywhere because it's just awful, self-pitying, morose kind of things, you know. But in order to get back to that light, you have to work through the darkness.
Well, let's start with light.
Would you
get to choose a poem? I'd be curious to see which poem you choose to read.
Okay. Where I find belief. In the rain as it spools late afternoons, skies gray, blankets layered around me on the porch. In the bluebird as he hops in the water and wriggles his feathers dry. In the silence of dawn snowfall, everything wrapped in lavender reflection, my nose pink and cold, while the trees breathe. In puppies as they swarm and wiggle and lick, puppy breath teasing my cheeks. In the honey glow of evening sunset, shadows of pine lengthening, a barred owl calling in the night.
You like Emily Dickinson?
I love Emily Dickinson.
There was a dissertation written by an Indian man, and he said in the introduction, Emily Dickinson found solace and comfort in the lap of nature.
Yes.
I thought, man, that's KB.
Yes, it is. It absolutely is. And Mary Oliver strikes me that way too. Sometimes I kind of get aggravated when people say that I'm a nature poet. But on the other hand, it makes me feel good too, because I do write a lot about nature, but the nature is... Not equating myself with Shakespeare here, but you know, Shakespeare used a lot of the microcosm, macrocosm in his plays to explain what was happening in people with what was happening in nature. And I think it's just easier for me to look at the nature and then go back through the pebbles of the things I've seen during the day and kind of equate that.
Yeah. You're not a nature poet, KB. No, what I liked about what he said about Emily, because and it struck me after having read, more than half the book, that notion of finding solace and comfort. Let's take holding the tide of
night.
So while that is a description of a point in the day and of the natural world at that point, that's one of the first instances of many, it seemed to me, where human beings were intruding on the natural world and breaking the rhythms. And it seems to me that in your work, it kind of goes back and forth, where either humanity is interrupting the natural flow and rhythm, or life is just interrupting it. That even in the midst of your reverie, there's those shadows.
Wow,
loss seems to shadow your work a lot.
It does. I need to have other people read it and tell me about it. I think that's a really good analysis that I don't think I had thought about. But yeah, I think. As an only child, I prefer my own company. I prefer books. I prefer sitting and looking at nature. And so when people come along, a lot of times it's, I'm perfectly happy doing this thing by myself, whatever it is. But, people are really important, and I always have to remind myself that. And so while maybe they do seem like intrusions at first, that's really the whole point of why, we should be here and be part of community, to help each other out. But I find my solace and comfort in nature. So if I can do that, then I can leave that nature and go into my community and share that with people who need it from me, because other people need people,
One of my favorite poems is My Lost Child. Oh. I think that's so cool. I mean, I can see myself in that too, in childhood.
Yes, yes.
And that doesn't necessarily mean the time frame. It's like we can still go back there, right? We can go to the beach and get that buzz again and feel that way again.
Yeah, hopefully.
It seems like you did there, even if it's only in your imagination.
Right. It doesn't have to be, completely lost. I think, but you. If we don't give ourselves time, and a lot of people don't these days, I mean, we immediately have people around us, we immediately have videos on, we immediately turn on the music, and I'm guilty of all that too. Our audiobooks, our podcasts, everything is just geared toward us, things coming at us. And if we don't give ourselves time for reflection, then we do lose those things. And I think it's really important to have time. I tell my students, I say, I know it's really scary sometimes, but go sit in your car, and when you drive home, don't turn on the music. Don't turn on anything. Just sit with yourself and think about the day, and you'll be surprised at some of the things you come up with. What I like about books, though, still is that when I pull out a dictionary or a thesaurus, instead of just looking at whatever's on the computer, as I am using tactile, feeling those pages, I see a lot of other words that I hadn't thought about or I didn't know, and then I get absorbed in that. So it's a different kind of, people talk about you get on the internet and you look for one thing and then you start going down rabbit trails. But I mean, I did that with books, but a book is not an endless, an infinite thing that you can keep following, and at some point I get tired of looking at the book and I close it. Whereas, there's so much animated stuff coming at you on the screens that, oh, wow, this is something else, that's great. Oh, yes, let me look, let me follow this. And So I don't know. I like that you said it's a different way to learn. And so we need to start coming to terms with how our teenagers and our children are learning now.
Yeah, and you know, I was thinking about one of my professors in English in graduate school, who was just so excited about the notion of hypertext. It was brand new at that point. She said, "Oh, you have no idea. You can just follow that word, and it'll take you into a whole other world."
Oh, you goodness, know? That just
and it is it is and it's I want. It seems to me it would be almost overwhelming for a younger person who's trying to sort it all out.
Well, that may be why they have some issues with feeling overwhelmed. They do feel overwhelmed by a lot of things, and maybe that's the reason, is that it's not really pressure from anyone real. It's that computer, the internet, the social media stuff coming at them that they feel that pressure from.
Which I hadn't thought about that, but it seems to me that maybe that's one of the ways your poetry works for you, is that you're able to stop all of that.
Mm-hmm. And focus, yeah.
And stop time almost, even though a lot of the time you're writing about time, the passage of time or just the shifts in the light. I mean, if you're just joining us, our guest is poet KB Ballantyne. This is Writers in the Round, and KB's most recent collection of poetry is called The Light Tears Loose. But light is a theme in much of your work, I think, isn't it?
It is. It is. And I'm working on another manuscript, and every time I pull out a poem to put in that manuscript, I think, have I used this before? Because it's got light in it. And so I think automatically, did I put that in, you know, The Light Tears Loose? And then I didn't. And I thought, I got to stop writing about light and dark, but it's so hard because it's there every day. It's in nature, it's in people, and, you know, just it comes at you. And so when I drive to work, sometimes I see right now, you know, I drive to work in the dark and I watch the moonlight shifting. And if I'm on bus duty, standing outside out back, I can watch the sun rise. And so I am spending time watching the light a lot of times while things are happening. People are moving around, doing things around me, driving in cars or walking across the ball field or whatever. And so I'm surrounded by light, and it calls my attention. It's just something I love.
Well, it's yin and yang, isn't it?
Right. Yeah.
And that's how your book is divided too, in a sense, between the dark and the light.
Right.
We completely skip by you reading your poem, My Lost Child.
Oh, I didn't realize I was going to read. Okay. My Lost Child. My lost child dances on the salt marsh, peers between cord grass as she hides and seeks between the dunes. She hops with oyster catchers and foaming wavelets and scurries across the sand with fiddler crabs. She skips from the water over the rack to brush sea oats as they curve and sway back in the wind. Farther into the tree line, she dodges saw palmettos, white pines, until she discovers the live oak, the stippled shade that veils her freckles, her sun-bleached hair. Silent as the deer she follows, she tilts her head at the cicada's garbled oaths, the sizzle of waves rushing the shore. Where she strokes the bark, moss appears. Then she is gone.
You can see that little sprite, you know. listening to you read that, the other thing that occurred to me reading your work is there's quite a lot of onomatopoeia in your work. And I was wondering if Gerard Manley Hopkins is somebody you've read much, because he liked nature too. And
yes. When I first started writing poetry, my first collection was a Celtic collection. And I was getting my MFA at Lesley in Cambridge, and I had to come up with a thesis, and I met Ron Rash, and I don't know if you've met him, but he is a fantastic Appalachian writer. He writes novels, short stories, and poetry. When you read his novels, you know he's a poet, because he doesn't use anything that's not necessary, and the language is just so beautiful. And when I was reading his work to do my thesis, I got a chance to talk with him, and we started talking about Gerard Manley Hopkins and talking about his style of writing and just kind of the Irish and the Scottish people who came over from the old country and settled in the Appalachian Mountains. And it's really good information, the language, the rhythm, you know, choosing specific words. I love verbs, and I love assonance and all of that. Like we were talking about earlier, I think it does help me focus. I can tune out a lot of the stuff that's going on in the background and just concentrate on what's the best word, you know, what would work here, what will paint the best picture for the reader.
He was an interesting guy. He apparently didn't like modern English and was much more inclined to go back to old English, and he also liked Gaelic, I think, because he started studying the Welsh language.
Mm-hmm. The Welsh, yeah. I was trying.
You have an Irish heritage, I think.
Irish and Scottish, yes. Mm. And I was trying to think of, Cunhangath, I think, is the word that Ron Rash was telling me about it.
He makes up words, right?
Yes, it's the style that Hopkins was using. So.
Oh, really? Mm-hmm. That's what it's called?
Cunhangath, yeah, something like that.
What does that mean?
Oh, I have to get my notes out, Richard.
But it's something, I imagine it's something to do with the sound of words.
It is.
As much as it is.
How to put the words together. Mm. It might be the way he puts the hyphenated words together.
Well, you just, so often you use words for sound, mm-hmm. and sound in your work, you know. But before we get off the light, one of the last poems in that collection, or that section, is called Darkness to Hold. So it's about, while we, as you were saying, you know, you're delighting in the sunrise and the beginning of the day and the light coming and all that. This is a poem that many of us probably can relate to. It's like, well, I'm not sure enough. Let's hold off the light for a while. Let's stay here and...
with that the next cup of coffee, right?
Or even before that, you know, before we even come to consciousness, and we're just like, you know,
don't wake
me up yet, you know?
True. Darkness to hold. Listen to the stars breathing in the night. Curse the dawn that steals your dreams, while rose and lavender unstitch horizon seam and bluebirds bunch the feeder, one red-bellied woodpecker tapping you awake. You stumble into this world, this life, this day, trade vivid visions for monochrome moments, bliss orphaned, forgetfulness splintered, the unblinking sun yawns. Work calls you into 8x8 cubes, time measured in ticks of two blades dragging across a face, your skin, your thoughts. Listen, listen to the stars breathing on the other side of the sky, waiting with your dreams. Nightingale and lark singing, shadows knitting the dark.
I can so relate to that. I love that description. And, you know, I think we all have that sense. Not every morning, perhaps, but there are mornings.
Yes.
I wasn't ready for this.
And the colder the morning is, the more I feel like that.
That's probably got a lot to do with it. But then as you move into the dark... Then you start grappling with that which none of us wants to come to terms with. You know, we all at some point have to accept that we're going to have to let go. And there's that beautiful description of the person's face. We sense the next world stenciled under your skin, in your eyes. Ooh.
Yeah, that was from my father-in-law. Which poem was that?
It's called Time's Brief Shade. Yeah. And I just, as I said before, there are such vivid pictures in your writing, and we all know what that looks like. Somebody who's skin almost looks like tissue paper.
Mm-hmm.
You can see through it. You know?
And the trick is to say that without saying something that you've said 1,000 times or that everybody says, and that's really difficult.
It's extremely difficult.
I think that's what I like about poetry is the precision of trying to say it right and uniquely.
Yeah, I thought it was so interesting that you don't have patience with the novel, and yet I think poetry takes an enormous amount of patience because it's a novel in miniature, really, isn't it?
That's a good way to put it. I think the patience I lack is that I'm not getting finished with it fast enough, and so a poem is something that's, you know, it's almost I can hold in my hand and can take it with me throughout the day and keep my mind going over it and over it and choosing the right words. Whereas a novel, there's that whole stretch of, you know, the whole scope of eternity that you can write about, and you know which part am I going to focus on, and then I don't know.
I know exactly what you mean. Yeah, and I think perhaps that for many of your poems is to capture a feeling,
yes,
a moment.
Yes. Yeah. The lyric poem. I always thought I was more of a narrative writer, which is the storyteller one.
Mm-hmm.
And the more I look at some of my poems, the more I think maybe I am leaning toward the lyric side, which is the capturing the moment, you know, just a moment in time.
And yet, again, you know, the notion of it being a sort of novel in miniature, there's a story in many of these poems.
Hopefully.
Oh, I think so.
and if not my story, the reader's story,
yeah,
is what I'm hoping for.
Yeah, because I think, you know, and it may be, you know, me reading into it something that's not there, but there's a companion piece to Time's Brief Shade, Before You Were No Longer There to Kiss.
Yeah.
That seems to be about the loss of somebody again.
Yes.
You never say that. And because you don't say it, it becomes that much more poignant and that much more sort of putting your finger on how that feels. I don't want to say goodbye. I don't want to.
Right.
You know, I don't want to let go.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think when I tell people, you know, I hesitate to tell people backstories until after they've read the poems.
Mm.
Because I don't want to put in their head what I'm thinking. I want them to be able to internalize whatever's, you know, what's happening with them by using those words. And so I try not to say specifically it's, you know, this person or that person or use language where somebody's going to know it's my child, my father, my cousin, whatever, just so they can plug in whoever it is for them, because we've all got somebody that this will work for. And you think about that person.
That's true. But I was just wondering if you're ever surprised by people's interpretations of your poems.
Oh yes, yes, and sometimes, you know, sometimes I come off sounding a lot smarter than I think. They say, "Oh well, you must have done this and this," and I look at it and I go, "Wow, it does do that," but I didn't realize I was doing that. I'm sure I did that intentionally, subconsciously, intentionally, but. You know, I think a lot of times it's really what the reader is seeing. And when they say it, it doesn't mean that I wrote it. It just means that I can also see what they're saying. And I think that's a good thing, too, because, again, once it leaves you, once it's published, once it's out there, it belongs to everybody, and they can make of it what they will. And if it means that to them, you know, hopefully I can see that, too, even though it might mean something different to me.
Yeah, it goes back to what you were saying earlier about the poem. I forget exactly how you put it, but basically that the poem comes alive in the reader's mind.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's whatever the reader makes of it is what the poem is about,
right?
Regardless of what you may have intended.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody said, and I can't remember who it was now, somebody said at one point I read talking about song lyrics, if nobody hears it, song doesn't exist.
Oh, that's sad.
It is, isn't it? But at the same time, it's basically saying the same thing. That, you know, people, well, aside from the fact, you know, that people often totally mishear lyrics and come up with something completely different than the person intended.
Yes.
You know, it's like, I guess a song or a poem or a short story or a novel, it's all about something that you wanted to share, a thought or an idea or a feeling you wanted to share.
Mm-hmm. Especially.
And are you ever tempted to say, "Oh, wait a minute, no, you got it wrong. That's not what I meant." You know.
No, I don't think so, because I think I agree with the whole idea that this is the poem as I wrote it, and this, I can give you my backstory for it, but if you take it, and you know, there's stuff there that actually resonates with you, then I'm happy for you to take it and let it mean that for you.
There's this notion that a good song should be both personal and universal.
Yes, absolutely.
Do you ever write with that thought in mind?
I don't. I just try to write the poem as it comes to me, and then I try to make it better and better as I focus on the language and the mechanics of it, and trying to clean it up so that it's the best it can be. And then I hope that rather than just being personal, it will also be universal.
Hmm. How do you write? Do you sit down consciously to write, or do they just kind of come to you when you're doing something else, and then you, like the one that came to you in the dream?
Strangely enough, I'm usually engaged in something else, and I'll hear a portion of a song or something on the television, or, you know, I'll read something in a book and I have to stop and I write myself a little note. And I try just to leave it at the little note at first, because I don't want to unintentionally steal whatever it actually came from. And so I just write it down, and then I continue doing what I'm doing, and then I come back to it later and say, okay, can I do something with this? Do I still have any emotional pull from this idea that I heard about? And sometimes I look at it and I go, what was that? And I toss it in the trash, because I have no idea.
But you do set aside time when you sit down to write and develop those ideas?
Absolutely.
That?
Yes. Yeah. And each year I get a little more strict with myself or maybe it's more generous with myself in allowing myself that time to write. Because a lot of times that's the thing that calms and focuses me and allows me to go out into my real life where I have to work. And I think, it's okay, I've got this other thing that I'm coming back to that I can do that makes me happy, that brings me joy, that I can share with other people. You know, I like going to places with other writers. I like sharing ideas. I like being in my writing groups and just talking about writing. I love in my teaching when we talk about writing, especially when I teach creative writing, and we get to go over all the different things and sharing with students all the different aspects of creative writing, and seeing them see it for the first time as something that's technical rather than just, oh, well, I like to do this blog, or I like to do this flash fiction story online, and they see real merit in what they're doing.
In that it's not just random thoughts, it's shaped, and it's to make a point.
Right, and it's not something shameful that they have to go into a corner. You know, it's not sports. It's not something that's lauded, you know, publicly in front of arenas and stuff. And so a lot of people, I think, especially young children and teenagers, think that it's not necessarily a worthwhile thing because they're not getting a lot of praise for it. Mm. And that's a sad thing. Barnes & Noble has done a really good thing with doing their novel, writing a novel thing, the Novel Week, and bringing novels to fruition for young writers and giving them that acclaim. A star here in downtown, Starline Books, does a great job in bringing all different readers to her store and letting them read and letting them perform and recite and share. And I think if enough people show interest like that, then I think people will understand that there is value in the writing. We don't have to have great big grandstands of arenas of people. You know, it's just a different kind of interest.
And then there's poetry slams.
Oh, yeah. Which
has changed, you know, young people especially, it seems, has changed their relationship to the written word, to language. I don't think it's anything new. I think it's just brought things full circle that we're going back into because of the, maybe in part it's because of the internet, but we seem to be in an oral age again.
Right. Yes. I've been thinking about that lately, how a lot of things are not written online. There are a lot of podcasts and movie clips and YouTube videos and things like that. And I think maybe I should do that. And then, you know, my writing isn't really geared toward that so much. It's more geared for, you know, reading and contemplative kind of thing, which is why I think it's good to have both kinds of poetry. Everybody's good at different things. Some people are good at both. I am not good at performance poetry. I do not do well under pressure like that. I just go blank. But I love watching that. I get a charge out of the power of the immediacy of the words and the person who's saying it and how they want us to hear it. My mom tells me that she likes to hear me read my poems because then she knows how I want her to hear it instead of just in the book. And I say, well, you know, you can read it like you want to, but she wants to know how I would want to do it. So, you know, there's that too.
Yeah, and I'm not sure that she's alone in that. I understand what you're saying about performance poetry, and that's a particular way which seems to be fairly heavily influenced by hip-hop and hip-hop culture and that mode of expression. But so many of your poems are almost like a reverie, and I can see that they would lend themselves to being read and that people would really enjoy listening to them, not only because of the pictures that you're painting, but also because of the sound of the words, because you like the sound of words so much.
I do. You're right. I mean, if people don't mind listening to a softer, slower kind of language, then yes, I can do that. But, you know, the performance poetry is generally the really powerful, a lot of times angry, or not necessarily even angry, but passionate, really passionate. And I think mine are more subdued comparatively.
Well, that's a place where you go to get away from the noise and
right,
the anger, isn't
right.
it?
Right, right. So it's the opposite reason, yeah.
But then we get to darker. And one of the first poems is Time is a Crooked Thing.
Ooh. Oh, yes. Yes, it is.
And right almost adjacent to that is How Cruel the Days, which is even more so. Oh, my God.
My mom was not really happy with me for writing that poem, I have to tell you. And that was a really hard poem for me to write because I don't like to write about ugly things. I don't like to write about really sad and depressing things that actually happened to me. It's easier for me to write a sad thing about somebody else because then I'm not getting that firsthand experience of trying to choose the right words over a memory that is in my head.
Well, I thought what was most striking, well, two things. Obviously, the topic itself and the subject matter is striking. It's about the death of an animal in two different poems. It's one and two within the same poem.
Mm-hmm.
One that was close to you and one a stranger.
No, both of them were.
Oh, you knew the other dog?
Oh, sorry, the other dog, yes. Yeah, the first dog was just a...
Yeah, I didn't
know that dog, but I saw that happen,
right.
And it was just horrific for me. I remember calling somebody and crying on the phone, and it was a dog I didn't even know. You know, I just thought, I can't go to teach my class tonight. I was so upset.
Well, you care about animals.
Yes.
you have a deep and abiding relationship with the natural world. I can understand how it would affect anybody to some extent, I think, to see something like that. I'm happy to say I've never seen it. To see a dog accidentally killed,
yeah.
Right in front of you. Ooh. What about Time is a Crooked Thing, though? That's a nice.
That's more about people.
that's a reflection on for you too, right?
Right, right. One of my favorite Sylvia Plath poems is Mirror. And I've always been interested in the idea of reflection in that poem and how she talks about the fish rising up and the old woman rising up. And then I saw this quote by Mae Sarton, which says, "We have to break the mirror to be ourselves." And I thought, oh, wow. So what we're looking at is kind of what we've boxed ourselves into, literally in the mirror. And if we really want to break out of that, we have to not pay attention to what's in the mirror.
Now, do you ever get the feeling when you're looking in the... Really?
Yes, I do.
That's not how I feel.
Yeah, it's actually... That's more of when somebody asks me my age, and then I say my, I think about my age, and then I go, oh, wow, that used to sound old, you know, and now it sounds less and less old.
Well, it's kind of interesting, isn't it, how, at least it is for me, how you perceive these things. I can't think of any example off my top of my head as to who was saying it, but I can hear people saying things like, so-and-so is old. I think, really?
Mm-hmm.
I don't see them that way at all anymore. And that idea that because they're old or older, that they're removed from us and they're removed from our experience, maybe that's part of it. Once you've had the experience yourself, you realize it isn't that much different than whether you're an 11-year-old or a 71-year-old.
Right.
You kind of see the world the same way.
Right. But I think it's difficult when we're in that prime age
mm-hmm.
of late teens, early 20s.
To imagine it. It's
really, I mean, everybody seems old, you know. 30 seems old. And now I think, oh, 30, that was great.
Yeah, their, you know? Their experience seems so incomprehensible.
Yes, you know? Yes.
Mm. So. But I thought this is a wonderful, the word is escaping me, but a reflection on just getting older.
Mm-hmm. Time is a crooked thing. Though silver and exact, the mirror has no memory, no stop or start or rewind. Each day an exercise in remembering who I am. Unremarkable, ordinary, day unravels into day. Brief bliss or grief to cling, to sift through, to find myself again. Lines deepen, shadows darken, and we must lean closer, ever closer, to see. Photos flaunt the proof. Had I shattered that mirror when it first exposed the truth, I could have hoarded the image of youth, the one my brain still imagines, though my body begins its betrayal. Squatting for the dropped sock, stooping to tie the shoe, the petty aches and pains when cold weather comes, when dawn silvers the sky with dew. Oh, I should have known when the wren stopped singing, the day was done.
And the collection ends with more light.
And thankfully.
A poem, I think it may be one of the last poems, is called Recreation. And you were saying earlier that you consider yourself a realist, and there's this sense that for you as a person that life and death are one and the same. That in the, you know, that notion that in the midst of life we're also in the midst of, which I guess is true.
Every minute we're alive, we're just dying a little bit.
That seems to be something that resonates for you, because you talk about that in terms of the natural world a lot,
mm-hmm.
but also as in the poem we just listened to, you know, our own lives. But then there's the notion in your book, keep moving forward. On the other side is the light.
That's right. The only thing you can do is to keep moving forward. If you stop,
are we in your mind? Are we headed toward the light?
What, as a nation, as a as an individual?
Yeah. You know, is the whole cycle of our existence moving toward? You know, because people talk about that a lot, right? They say, "Oh, I saw a light; it was dazzling."
The
you know,
end
that
times.
Kind of thing. You know,
it's
rather an optimistic. vision of the end of everything, isn't it?
Well, I believe in God, and I think that when you die, you're going to be answering one way or another to an almighty power. And because of what I believe, you know, I'm looking forward to the light. And so I think that's what I hold on to anytime it gets dark and despairing and things don't work out like I think they should, you know, because in my world, you know, I should know what's best. And of course, that doesn't happen. And, you know, for a good reason, most of the time, you know, I find out later, sometimes days later, sometimes years later, you find out, you know, it was a good thing that it happened this way.
Yes, I think there's something comforting about that, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
That's perhaps one of the most comforting things about getting older is that you do come to that realization that as much as you have put so much energy into trying to control it, there was a good reason you couldn't control it.
Right. And do you really want to? I mean, we think we do at the time, but then it would have changed everything. And so, you know, it's as much of a control freak as I am, I do find myself letting go of things more and more and actually feeling a lot freer. For that, a lot more happy that, okay, I don't have control over that, accept it and move on.
That's a kind of Buddhist notion, right?
I don't know. I haven't studied the Buddhist tradition.
except that, it's basically that prayer that they teach people in recovery programs too, isn't it? To come to peace with that which you cannot control and just learn to live with the way things are.
Well, you're only responsible for your own actions. You cannot help what other people take away from what you say or what you do. Your intention is one thing, and then what they walk away with is something else. And, you know, long, hard living has taught that, that you know, if you're doing something with the best intention and somebody walks away angry, you know, you can't do anything about that. And so at some point you have to realize I'm okay with what I did or what I said if I did that with the best intention.
Yes, I agree. I think in the end, that's all that really matters. What was your motivation?
Right.
You know, why'd you do that? And if you had, as you say, if you had good intentions, you know, despite the aphorism about good intentions, I think that that's all we can expect from anyone really, isn't it?
Yes.
And certainly this is a collection written with good intentions, I think.
Yes, I think so.
Our guest, KB Ballantyne, the collection is called The Light Tears Loose. KB is also part of the Chattanooga Writers Guild, and your writer's workshop is this weekend, the 18th?
Yes, it is. It's going to be great. So many great writers, Cynthia Robinson-Young, and I've just lost who the other poetry person was. They're going to be doing poetry workshop and craft and reading. And then there's going to be Denton Loving and Kelly Z. Riley for the fiction. And, and I've lost my nonfiction people in my head too.
But it's a whole day of
it's a whole day
people talking
of
about
wonderful,
the craft.
Wonderful opportunity to sit and talk with other writers and to learn from people. And when you sit around at lunch or afterwards, you know, just discussing the things that you've learned or your ideas that you've had, you take home a lot of really good ideas.
And you realize you're not alone.
Absolutely. You realize that there are other people like you, and it is, you know, it is ambitious and it's scary and it's wonderful. It's all of those things to put yourself on paper. It's not like a sport where you go out and you catch a ball and, you know, and then that's an athletic thing with the body, and you can do it or you can't do it. But when you're writing something, when you're doing art, when you're performing music, a lot of times that is coming from your soul. And that's the scary part, because you're letting other people see into you, not what you can do, but you're letting them see into you. And
That's
terrifying.
Different kind of athleticism.
It is. Mm. Exercise and courage is what that is.
So much fun to talk to you. Should we close with the recreation? Would that be okay?
Sure, that's great. I would like to preface this with I have the best neighbors in the world. And they have, well, right now they're 4 and 2 years old.
Oh, really?
And yeah. This one was written when the four-year-old was 2 or 3 years old. And I just love, you know, seeing their little faces. And it reminds me, it reminds me of the wonder of youth. And so I get a lot of really good ideas just watching them play when I get a chance to do that. So this is called Recreation. If blue is dream, what then innocence? Federico Garcia Lorca. It's the laughter of your three-year-old neighbor when you sail soapy bubbles, her fingers reaching for the drifting moons. It's the adoration in your dog's eyes when you nuzzle close and stroke his ears, even when shoe leather scatters the hallway. Your son's trust when you subtract the training wheels, when you run behind him as he cycles away. It's your mother losing her words and her way, letting you lead her back to the white-walled room, tuck her into bed. Iridescent, transparent, reflective, the world balanced on a quivering wand, forming with your breath.
I love all the pictures and images in that. Thanks, KB. It's been so much fun talking to you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And I'm sure it's not too bad. And